to avoid fainting, keep repeating.
It's only a podcast. It's only a podcast.
Good evening, good afternoon, good whatever time of day be, folks. Welcome to part two on Podcast Macabre of our interview with Frank Dietz. We spent the good part of part one talking about his upcoming documentary, Kong, Long Live the King, and the monsters and such. And we briefly got into some listener questions. And now we've got all sorts of other things, because really you've got about, at least from, if I count back right on the IMDb, at least a 30-year career between those first horror movies and then all the way through your animation and your documentary work now. Is that about right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Thanks for making me feel old, dude. You know, it sometimes it just surprises me when I think back on how long ago this all started, because it doesn't seem like it. You know, it doesn't not feel like almost 30 years, but it is what it is, you know. It is actually 30 years. I mean, 86, 90s, yeah. My first movie was Zombie Nightmare. Do you guys want to, should you guys introduce yourselves?
Yeah, that's what I just thought. We kind of skipped over our intros because we're just continuing the recording and we're loving this. So I'm Chris.
I'm Joe.
I'm Jenny, and our silent partner is Don, our King Kong.
Yeah, for anyone who missed part one, Don's battling a cold right now, and halfway through part one, her voice finally crapped out, so she's relaying messages through our instant messaging, and we're posting up questions as they come from her. So, hi, Don.
Hi, Don.
I feel like a medium. Got my Ouija board over here.
Yes, Jenny is just going to be channeling Dawn through the rest of this interview.
Suddenly I have images of Whoopi Goldberg and Ghost. Push a penny across the floor, Dawn.
Just stay away from that ceramic wheel, though, okay? Because that's been very different. But, you know, what you were just talking about, I mean, 30 years, it doesn't seem like 30 years. I have a grown daughter. I have two daughters. My older daughter is a grown person now. And, you know, it just doesn't seem real. It doesn't seem possible. What are you talking about? I'm only 26 years old. How is that possible? But, you know, I think it's a good thing, though, because I try. I mean, sometimes the physical aspects of becoming older, you can't avoid. But, you know, I think that having that 26-year-old energy in your head is an important thing to have if you're still working and you're trying to achieve new things all the time. You know, I talked about in the last episode, very kind of jokingly, but talked about being diversified, and I think that has a lot to do with why I'm still here. Is that I learned a lot of different skills, so that if one of them wasn't working out, I could turn to the other. And this is something I recently did. My alma mater, which was the State University of New York in Oswego, they flew me back up there to do a series of classes and do some seminars and so forth over the course of a few days. And, you know, one of the things that I kept stressing to these kids was have a backup plan. And these were mostly kids who were in creative, by the way. Mm-hmm. I was talking to art classes and filmmaking classes and so forth. You know, have a backup plan, because you never know when the thing that you feel like you're okay, this is what I'm doing now, and this is going to last me the rest of my life, that can go away in a heartbeat. A perfect example for me was Disney. I was a 2D artist, and all of a sudden, it wasn't exactly all of a sudden, but quicker than was expected, 2D was gone. And suddenly the job that I thought was going to carry me, you know, to the retirement was obsolete. And it wasn't like I could even go, I could go to another studio and do it, because all of the studios were dropping 2D at the time. This was just 2002 or whatever it was. And I was lucky. I was very lucky, because before going to Disney, I had a career as a screenwriter. I wasn't allowed to do continue screenwriting while I was at Disney, because I was under the umbrella of the Walt Disney Company, and so to work for any other company would be a conflict of interest, and so basically anything that I did while I was working for Disney belonged to Disney. But the minute I was done with my time at Disney, because I had established a small career in screenwriting before that, I was able to go back to that, where a lot of the people that were my peers at Disney at the time, that's all they knew. They had come out of Cal Arts and gone, you know, college, gone directly to work for the company and had worked there for 20, 30 years, and that was the only skill that they knew. You know, and so I was very lucky that I had learned a previous skill and had established some kind of pedigree in it. Regardless of how well the films were received, it didn't matter. I had an agent, and I had somebody that had people that would remembered that I was capable of doing good work. So I was able to then essentially just go back in time and go back through what I was doing before the 8 years or so I was at Disney. So I think it's an important thing to learn more than just the one thing that you're doing, especially in a creative environment. I mean, look at Joe Dante is a guy who, you know, started out editing trailers for Roger Corman, and then turn that into you know, directing great movies like The Howling and Piranha and Gremlins and so forth. And so always be looking at what else is out there, what else is within your reach is part of my philosophy.
So I could ask beyond, because I know at least I did, and I think Don watched as well. We did watch the Mystery Science Theater 3000 of Zombie Nightmare. Because we had a hard time finding the movie any other way.
So. Well, it is out there. They did, but here's the thing. Now, the only reason it is available, you can find it probably on Amazon on DVD.
Right.
I forget which company, but the original. I'm talking about the original version, not the MS version. Because they brought me in to do a feature length audio commentary for that. Nice. And they did a whole interview, an on-camera interview as well, with me and my old friend John, who wrote the screenplay for it. And but that never would have happened. I talked about this briefly in the earlier segment. That never would have happened if Mystery Science Theater had not picked up that film and essentially raised it out of obscurity. It would be a forgotten film, and rightly so.
Well, and of course, if we're talking Zombie Nightmare, we have to talk Rock and Roll Nightmare.
Yes, Rock and Roll Nightmare is crazy, the cult status of all of the films that we did, almost all of the films that we did in Canada during that time period, which was between 85 and 90, basically.
Yeah. Well, you definitely have an international market, because a fellow podcaster and horror movie fan, Wayne Talbot, who was over in Dublin, that when I said that we're getting you as a guest this weekend, he's like, "Oh, Rock and Roll Nightmare, that movie's fucking deadly."
And it is. Here's the thing about that. I've never made any apologies for any of those movies, because they were my film school, number one, You know, that's where I learned how movies are made. I mean, aside from reading in magazines, which is not the same as having hands-on experience, of course. And it's funny because the way it happened was, I had only ever been on the set of one movie, and it was just really random. A friend of mine in my hometown of Port Washington, his parents were quite wealthy, and they had a big mansion out in Sands Point, which is the peninsula of Port Washington, in a very, very exclusive area. I mean, the Allman Brothers lived there, and John Cassavetes, and all kinds of people. And they had this big, beautiful mansion that sat out on the Sound, Long Island Sound. And my friend Scott, he called me up one day and he said, "Hey, they're shooting a big Hollywood movie here at my house. Do you want to come and watch and see the film?" And I was like, "Sure." And I didn't know what the movie was. I had no idea. And got there and discovered that the movie was The King of Comedy. And which is a Martin Scorsese directing, Robert De Niro and Jerry Lewis, the stars of the film. And I was floored. I couldn't even believe what I was seeing. And that was a very important day for me. And I talked about this on the Tom Holland episode or one of them. Recently, and that, like, all of my eyes were suddenly, open to really what making a movie is like, and seeing how many people are involved and what it takes to light a scene, and what it takes to to shoot a scene from several different angles and so forth, and how quiet you have to be on the set and so forth. And so that was my only experience of real movie making. I'm not counting the Super 8 movies I made, as a kid, which some of them are on YouTube, by the way, if you want to see them. They're pretty funny. But I was then working as an artist in New York City, and I wasn't really thinking about making movies. I was still loving movies and reading magazines and so forth, but it wasn't in my foreseeable future. And my old friend John Pisano, who I grew up with, calls me out of the blue, basically, and said, "Hey, you know what? I wrote a script for a monster and horror movie, and they're going to be making the movie up in Montreal." And he said, "And I wrote this part," and I kind of wrote it with you in mind, because John and I had done many plays and so forth back in hometown. And he said, "Do you want to audition for it?" And I was like, "Yeah, I think that would be fun." Like, get me out of this job that I'm in right now. Absolutely. So I went and I auditioned, and the director liked me, and I got the part. So all of a sudden now I'm not working for this crazy toy inventor in New York. I'm flying up to Montreal, and I'm about to be in what I'm picturing to be this big Hollywood monster movie. And I'm the hero. I'm playing the hero, which is, so now I'm David Edison. You have to go listen to the first episode to understand what that is. But now suddenly I'm David Edison. And I get there, and I meet the guys who are doing the zombie makeups, and actually they're pretty good. They're actually cool. And then they tell me that my co-star is going to be the guy that if you had told me when I was 7 years old that I would someday not only meet him, but I'd be acting with him, I probably wouldn't have survived the shock of that news. But my co-star is going to be TV's Batman, Adam West. And so I'm living the dream here. And I was so excited. My first day, on the set, I was just so thrilled and so could not wait to meet Adam and do all this stuff. And then within a day or two, it started to dawn on me that this might not be quite the quality of movie that I was thinking it would be. This was not going to be the king of comedy. In a way, yes, but not good. and I tell you, it was. I've told this story before, but I'll tell you real quick. Is that this was the defining moment. We had just shot a scene at night where the zombie, I wasn't in the scene. I was watching, because even if I wasn't in any of the scenes, I would show up on set just to watch the film because I was fascinated and this was also new and cool. And we had just shot this film in the back of this like Dairy Queen place where the zombie kills the creepy little kid. The creepy little kid, who, by the way, went on to direct Night in the Museum and like 100 other like movies, right? And the John, my friend John, who was the assistant director, even though he directed a good deal of the film, went up to the director, and they just shot the master shot. The master shot, if you don't know, is the shot where you shoot the entire scene from a wide angle. And you get all the action in, and then after that is when you stop and you move in with the cameras to shoot what we call coverage, which are the close-ups of each different character in the scene. So the editor can cut away from the long shot to the close-ups, et cetera, et cetera. So we've just shot the master shot, and John goes up to the director and he says, okay, so we're gonna now we'll relight and we'll go in for coverage, right? And shoot the close-ups. And the director went, nah. You know what? You see the same thing in the close-up. And I saw the look on John's face, like he's basically just turned white, basically. And he looked over at me, and I didn't exactly get it, but I knew something was dreadfully wrong, you know. And as time went by, of course, I would learn exactly what was wrong with the director of the movie saying something like this. It meant that we were not pushing the envelope to make this movie as good as it could be. And then the budgetary cuts, you know, kept bringing it down and down and down, and it got cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. But we still gave it our all. The people that were invested into making a good movie, and you just carry on, and you just say, whatever else is happening, I'm going to do my best. I'm going to do the best acting that I can possibly do in this role. And Adam and I had our scenes together. Most of them were in this. Little office that we tried to turn into a police station. And it looked like the worst police station ever. it looked like an office, just some bad carpeted office, you know, where we put up some things on the wall that was supposed to look like, you know, it was a police station and it failed miserably. But Adam and I still approached our characters with the same investment that you've given to any you know multi-million dollar movie, because it wasn't going to be our fault if this didn't work, you know, and that's the attitude. It's just like no matter what the situation is, you can't give up on it. You still have to give it as much as you can give. Because in the end, it might work out okay. In the case of Zombie Nightmare, you know, the problems with it outshined what was good about it. But in the end, this strange twist of fate probably helped it become the cult film that it is now. Uh-huh. And so, I make no apologies for that. And the same thing with the next film, which we were planning Rock and Roll Nightmare. It wasn't called Rock and Roll Nightmare, by the way. It was called The Edge of Hell, which was the title I came up with. While we were in a hotel room while we were filming Zombie Nightmare. And John Fasano was on the phone with the guys who were investing in our next film. And John, I don't think we even had a script at that point. And John was just throwing out the concept. And I remember I was standing between, the TV was on in the hotel room. And it was during the day, it was the middle of the day, so the only thing on back then were soap operas. Right? Mm-hmm. And John was standing across the room, and he was on the phone, and he's talking to these guys, and I hear him say, "Oh, what's the title?" And he looks over at me, and he's just like, he doesn't have an answer for them. And I'm looking down at the TV, and I see what's coming on next. It is The Edge of Night. And so I just turned to John and said, "The Edge of Hell." And John goes, "The Edge of Hell is the name." Yeah, isn't it great? It's a great title, right? And that's how that happened. That's how that title happened. Now, unfortunately, and in Canada, it is still, the Canadian release, it's still called The Edge of Hell. Mm. And if you get the DVD that came out like 2 or 3 years ago, that print is actually, you'll see, it still says The Edge of Hell. But the American domestic release, they decided for whatever reason to call it Rock and Roll Nightmare. Which maybe is a better title for the film that it is.
Don's dogs are guesting on the show. Oh, they tend to do that now and then.
Yeah, that's actually funny. I actually thought it was my dog. Headphones on. So. In the big picture, maybe Rock and Roll Nightmare is the more appropriate title. But we were planning that movie already while making Zombie Nightmare. So we were pushing forward. So it didn't, however Zombie Nightmare came out, it didn't matter. We were already looking forward to the next one. And that's pretty much how it went for the next 4 years with us, making those Canadian Four, as we like to call them, starting with Zombie Nightmare, which, by the way, also I'll tell you, was, as even though we knew that it wasn't going to be as good as we had hoped it would be, we still had a great time making that movie. We were always having fun. And especially with Adam. Adam's such a genial and very, very funny guy. Great sense of humor. We had a blast working with him, and Tia Carrera was really sweet. She was really nice. We had fun. We were living the dream. If it wasn't quite the dream that we expected at first, that's fine. We were still doing it. We were not sitting in our living room on a couch, drinking beer, watching some other movie, and talking about how shitty it was and how when we make our movie, it'll be better. It doesn't matter if our movie wasn't better. We were making a movie. So we were actually doing it. And that was more important than anything else, probably.
Right. So I did notice, looking back, found your sketchy blog, and just happened to be on the page that first came up. It had pictures of, did you make the chicken monster?
Yes, the chicken monster in Rock and Roll Nightmare, yeah. Well, that was fun. That was the thing about Rock and Roll Nightmare, was that we had a very, very low budget for that time, by the way. For that time, it was a very, very low budget. Zombie Nightmare, I think, was $350,000. For a low budget movie, that wasn't bad actually back then. But Rock and Roll Nightmare, we only had around $60,000, and John had fibbed to the investors and told them that we had matched funds. I don't know how he got away with it, but the investors thought we were making a $120,000 movie, when in fact we were not. So almost everyone that worked on that movie were wearing many hats. For months before we went up to that film was done in Toronto, as were the rest of them that we did up there. For several months before we when actually went up there and physically shot the film, we were working in John's basement in upstate New York, but just above New York, mm-hmm. White Plains, New York. And we were in his basement. We were making all those special effects. We were sculpting them. We were making the molds. We had a great guy named Tony Bua who came in and he was showing us how to make molds, how to create teeth, how to do blood effects. He was showing that we were learning as we were doing, but we were doing it. And I'm sure we were breathing in all kinds of nasty chemicals down in that basement, that effect, but we did it all. So on Rock and Roll Nightmare, I was in the movie as an actor. I was the second AD, and I created a whole bunch of the special effects. And I was a puppeteer when we were actually shooting. So those crazy little Cyclops guys. Were half of them at least were me. I know the one smoking the cigarette was me, and I think the one that gets the Coke can put on his hand was me. I created the squids also, the little one eyed squid monsters that we toss at Scott in the incredible
epic battle.
incredible climax of that film. Still, I love that people, almost every review, whether they love it as a cult film or they despise it as a dreadful film, all of them say the same thing, which is that the epic confrontation at the end of the movie between Thor and Satan has to be seen to be believed. And I'll tell you that about that. The guy that made that big puppet did just a terrible job. I mean, he had so much time to create that puppet, to make it so that it was basically a rod puppet, and you could put your hand up inside the head and work the head as a puppet. But the arms were all done with rods and so forth, and it was only from the waist up. And this guy, who's just an asshole, by the way, he made that thing weigh like 50,000 pounds. Jeez. It was so heavy that it was almost impossible to move. And so that whole sequence of having Thor fight this thing became that much more difficult and looks that much worse because the thing weighed, you know, like, I don't know, something like 150 pounds or something like that.
Oh, altogether.
I mean, I might be exaggerating. It seemed like it anyway. But just holding it up took, three people, except for Fasano himself, the director, who was a very beefy, very strong guy, was able to hold it up by himself on occasion, but not for very long.
Well, and Thor is no slouch either, to look at his physique.
Well, John, of course, was a rock star bodybuilder / any number of things. Thor's the first one to tell you. He's such a sweet guy. He really is. He's so genial. He's just, I really enjoyed working with John Thor. He was a lot of fun. In two films, actually. He was in Zombie Movie also.
Yep.
But I mean, the working conditions on Rock and Roll Nightmare were so challenging because we were in Toronto. It was November, which, it's in November in Toronto. It's cold in July at night,
mm-hmm.
And so in November it's cold. It's really cold. And we were shooting on this property that was off of, I think it was like off of Lake Ontario. It was really bitter cold. And so that was working against us also, is that the house that we were renting, that we were shooting in, it did not have electricity. It didn't have heat. We had our generators that we brought in those were used to run the lights and the camera and everything like that. But mm-hmm. and the unfortunate shower sequence that's in that film between Thor and Teresa is was brutal because
there was no hot water in that building. And so those people are essentially, you know, buck naked in a freezing cold shower while they're shooting that.
They didn't do much standing in the shower during that scene. Yeah. They kind of stayed to the back of the tub.
Yeah, they did their best. And, you know, and obviously, you know, being naked in a freezing cold shower does not show you off in the best light for anybody. it was sometimes brutal. I remember there was a scene where the bunch of us were supposed to enter from outside into the house, and there was a certain amount of heat inside the house from the lights. Like the camera lights give off a good deal of heat, so they can warm up a room very, very quickly. But the scene called for us to be outside first at night. And when John would call action, we were supposed to enter. The camera was inside the house. We were supposed to enter through the door and shut the door and take off our coats and whatever, make ourselves at home. So if you've ever been on a film set and seen how long it takes sometimes to tweak lights, John Cleese once said that, making a movie is like spending 8 hours at an airport. And it's kind of true. I mean, you do spend a lot of time waiting around. The last thing you want is to be waiting around in the bitter cold outside with the wind just blasting you, and waiting, praying for it to hear that wonderful word, action. And I can remember this so clearly, that we were out there, and there's six of us, I think, or seven, and we would all just be huddled together, you know, like, you know, penguins trying to keep warm, you know, in the Antarctic, you know, as this bitter cold is whipping against our bodies. And just all of us just huddled together, trying to utilize our own body warmth, and just going, please say action, please say action, please say action, please. And finally you hear action. And we go, scramble again, and we'd be like pushing each other out of the way to get through that door first, you know.
As a lifelong New Hampshire resident, this is all ringing very familiar.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure. Yeah, I went to school, you know, in Oswego, New York, which also sits on directly on Lake Ontario. And what you don't realize before you ever get to a place like that is when they say lake, unless you've lived there, you don't realize that a lake isn't like a little lake where you can see the other side. Lake Ontario, it looks like an ocean. You cannot see beyond the horizon. And that wind comes off of that lake, it is just colder than fuck. Pardon my French.
No.
There's no other description when it gets that cold.
Yeah. And seriously, it was like that on the set of this movie. It was that cold all the time. So we were battling not only our limited budget and our time constraints, because we only had, I'm going to say 10 days, I think, to shoot that entire movie. So that was working against us, and the environment was working against us. But we were loving every minute of it, because we were doing it. Again, we were doing exactly what we always wanted to do. We were making movies.
So, well, I got to ask, though, since it is a band movie, did you actually play your own guitar?
God, no. that was, by the way, it was the first of two movies where I was a bass player who could not play a lick of guitar. So it started to become my thing, you know. No, I could not play. I was trying to just fake it. And when they would go in for the close-ups, they would Jim, who was the drummer,
okay.
He also played the guitar. So basically what we do is I would get out of he would put on my costume and pick up the guitar, and they would frame the shot so that you couldn't see it was, you know, below the neck. And he would do some riffs on the guitar that were accurate. at least to, you know, for a guitar player. I don't know whether it actually matched the feedback we were getting, I mean, the playback we were getting.
Right.
But it was, at least he was doing actual chords, you know. I was just making up shit the whole time, you know. And so I got through that whole movie doing that. And then on Black Roses, John, I mean, I played a character in Black Roses named Johnny, who's like one of the main characters through the whole film. But then we had to go back and do a pickup shoot for a few days where we filmed another concert sequence that takes place at the very beginning of the film, pre-credit sequence. And so since the band members were all demons that were under heavy prosthetic makeup, John said to me, why don't you be one of the demons? Because no one's going to recognize you as Johnny later in the film. And, you know, and then you can be, you know, you can be on the set and be in the film again, and you can get to be made up as a monster, which is something that, you know, was on my bucket list for sure. And so I was like, sure, let's do that. And so then again, I end up being the bass player in the band, not being able to play one lick of guitar, and certainly not bass. And they tried to show me how to do it, and I was just a complete spaz. I couldn't fake it that good. So I just moved my arms around and strummed. You know, no one seems to complain about it much. So I guess that, you know, unless you're a guitar player, you no one cares. You know.
I gotta say a couple of little things that did stick out for me from Rock and Roll Nightmare was from the very opening when I was watching it. When your guy's van first comes into scene and is coming down the road. I just had to laugh a little bit.
Coming down the road.
Well, I had to laugh because I'm looking at the front of the van. I'm just trying to figure out, you know, where's the location at? And I see, oh, it's an Ontario license plate, but right below it is one of those USA 1 frames. So I'm like, I'm conflicted.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, Toronto does border New York.
Right.
So it wasn't that far from the border, so I'm not sure where we got the van from, honestly. And it's possible that I don't remember us having an art director. I don't think we did. I know that we had, you know, artists working on the makeups and so forth because I was in charge of them. But as far as other stuff like that is concerned, props and so forth, I really can't remember who we had working on that. I think it was the rest of us. It was John's wife maybe doing it. And so forth, but so where that van came from, I don't know. But that van sequence, we used to just long before it attained any kind of cult status. The van sequence cracked, and we would just laugh our asses off because the movie came up about 6 or 7 minutes short, according to the parameters that the investors had insisted on. The investors insisted that the movie had to be a certain length. It had to have a certain amount of monsters and a certain amount of tits. And we had to basically go back and fix certain things. Same thing happened with Black Roses, by the way. And one of the main things that we had to fix was the length of it. So you'll notice, number one, that the end credits are really slow.
Yeah.
Because basically you can add on another 2 minutes or so by slowing down the timing of the crawl. And the other thing to do is to edit it and hold on shots as long as you can. Or augment the movie. Do pickups, add scenes to the movie that can add a little time to it and not necessarily distract from the plot. Mm-hmm. Although the van sequence, the infamous van sequence, is ridiculous because it basically, what happened was the movie was wrapped. John was still up in Canada. I had gone home. The rest of us had gone home. John was still in Canada, and Thor lived in Canada. He's Canadian. So John basically got a hold of the van again, the same van. It must have belonged to somebody that worked on the movie, I'm guessing, now that I think about it. Anyway, So they got the camera, they got the van, they put John driving in the driver's seat, and they filmed all these shots of the van driving and with John Porter behind the wheel, and put some music behind it, and that was supposed to that added like another 2 minutes to the movie. And so between that and the end crawl and a couple of other little things here and there, we were able to get the movie to the whatever it is, 78 minutes or whatever it is that the investors required to basically meet whatever they insisted on, you know.
Right. I guess how intentional was it that your character's name was Roger Ebert?
Yeah, we hated that. I hate it. You know, I love John dearly, and he was a good friend of mine for a very, very long time. I didn't always love his dialogue or his choice of character names. that one in particular, you know, was so obvious and ridiculous, but his movie.
Yeah.
You know, it's his movie. It's his vision. And so I tell you what, it was easy to let that go because what John would let me do was sometimes write my own scenes. In particular, and this is before, you know, way before I came out to L.A. and actually started working as a screenwriter. Mm-hmm. So the very first scene that I ever wrote that got filmed and is in a movie is in Rock and Roll Nightmare, and it's the scene where my character and my wife, the character that's my wife in the film, are in bed together, and we're listening to. We have this cute little talk, a little conversation about being on our honeymoon and where would we'd rather be and so forth. And there was no dialogue in that scene originally. And John said, go ahead, write something. So I wrote this nice little scene between Roger and Mary Ebert. by the way, the actress in that scene, who played that character was not my wife, she is now. We got married actually a year after that, but that was great. I mean, that was one of the things that John allowed me to do, and then in Black Roses also allowed me to submit ideas and dialogue for my character. And that's really probably what sort of got me thinking about writing screenplays. I found I loved writing dialogue, and a lot of that comes from having been trained as an actor and understanding when dialogue can be read realistically, like when as an actor, I was able to look at the dialogue that I wrote and know whether an actor could really read that dialogue,
right.
And be too awkward or weird or too too obvious, too expositional, and so forth. So that was really training ground for what would eventually be one of my many careers as a screenwriter. So I was thankful to John for that. So I didn't mind living with the little things that I didn't like so much, like my character being called Roger Ebert.
I have to say, too, the one other thing that stuck out, I have fun. I pay attention to accents when I watch movies. It's just one of those things. Like it's a game I play with some of my friends, like watching Michael Fassbender. And it's like spot when his Irish comes out.
Sure.
It's usually when he's emotional or something. But
yeah, half of the cast of The Walking Dead are British.
Yes.
So you know, every once in a while you'll hear it come out a little bit. Mostly they're good though. But I know where you're going with this.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yes. At first I thought Stig was British. But then when someone called him a wallaby, I'm like, oh, he's supposed to be Australian. And then after he gets possessed by the demon, he sounds like Rod Serling.
Well, you know.
It was funny. I loved it.
But the funny thing about that is, yes, his Australian accent is terrible. But the idea was, and it doesn't quite come through, but the idea was is that he was supposed to be the character was supposed to be pretending it. And that's why when he becomes possessed, it goes away because he's not pretending anymore. So it actually did make sense, but it isn't played out correctly, so it doesn't right. come across right. So it just sounds like Jim is just doing a bad, you know, Australian accent.
I can get that. I mean that does make sense for the character now, because I mean you see people do that, putting on like the fake Mick Jagger, trying to be that British rock star type of affectation. And so I can get that now with the character. That makes total sense.
Yeah, and Jim isn't per se, it wasn't per se an actor. He was John's brother-in-law. He wasn't trained the way some of the rest of us were. I don't think he went to college for theater, mm-hmm. like I did, and like some of the other people in the film did. But he didn't necessarily have to. He wouldn't have the training to go and really study that dialect and practice right. that dialect. He didn't need to. For that character,
yeah. And of course, with the budget you guys were already working on, I doubt you had a voice coach. So,
we were lucky if we got peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for dinner on that set. So, yeah, voice coach, nah, not so much. a heater would have been nice, actually, in the living room, especially in the shower.
I was going to bring up from other things I've been. Research in here before we did the show, with the Canadian four, as you call them too, that I worked in a video store in high school, and I can honestly say I did see all four of these movies on the shelf at one time or another, and especially like Black Roses with the textured case. It was one of those things that just popped on the shelf and drew your eyes into it.
Yeah, that actually won an award. That video box won an award for, I guess it was one of the first times that that relief trick was used mm-hmm. on a video box, and it did a lot. I mean, those movies, at least the first three, did pretty well on VHS. I know the investors got their money back for sure. I don't think the Jitters did, But Black Roses certainly did. Black Roses did quite well on VHS, and part of the reason is because of that video box, because it really did stand out amongst all the other horror movies that were on the shelf in the VHS shop, and so people were attracted to it.
Yeah, there's some great.
It's like I'm off to the flame for me. I remember seeing it from across the video store. I'm like, I don't know what that is, but it's mine. Over. They're like, hey, Dad, we're watching this like metal horror movie tonight.
Well, I know there's I forget the name of it off the top of my head, but I know there's a documentary out there now that it does talk about video cover art. And, you know, I can say, too, as someone who worked in the video store, that with the different gimmicks that came out to draw your attention, you have the shelf space, you have to have something eye-catching that's going to make someone come over, pick up that display box, look at the back, and see what the movie's about, or just grab it off the shelf. And I always remember one of my all-time favorites, because we played with the gimmick all the time. It was the display box for Frankenhooker, because you could go over it, you could go over and push the button on it, and it said her catchphrase, "Want a date?"
Oh, that's Gene, but that's Lloyd, right? Was it Trauma or no?
I can't remember off the top of my head. It's been a while since I watched that one.
It wouldn't surprise me. I mean, you know, Lloyd Kaufman is the king of selling. That's what he does. So I think that was a Troma picture.
I'd have to check that one.
Or Heenan Lotter, like one day, all those guys that were making those movies back in that time period. The Times Square people, you know, Basket Case and Toxic Avenger and all those films that, you know, we loved. You know, we would watch those movies when we were working on creating effects for the other movies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we knew some of the people too, because, you know, there was a lot going on in New York at that time as far as low budget horror went. Certainly Troma was, you know, just killing it. You know, between Toxic Avenger and Class of Nukem High and this, you know, all these other films that they were cranking out. They were creating a whole subgenre.
Right.
And, you know, we were there at the same time, basically. You know, we were shooting our movies in Canada, but we were, you know, creating them down here.
Mm. So, I did see, though, are you guys still working on a book about the Canadian Four?
You know what? The problem with that was John Fasano and I had talked about it for a couple of years. And we even started gathering up, photos. I have a whole bunch of photos and stuff that I saved a lot of stuff from those films as mementos. I took a lot of pictures on set, and John did as well. And we had outtakes and all kinds of things. And so we had talked about doing like a coffee table book about those four films and that time period. But John passed away last year, and I don't think I'd want to do it on my own. I think that without him, it would be kind of hollow, and it wouldn't be it wouldn't be right because they were his movies, they were
right.
His vision, you know, and I feel like without his involvement in it, it would feel to me like a vanity project for myself, and I'm not interested in doing that really. So
okay.
So without John,
that makes sense.
I doubt it.
Yeah,
yeah, totally understandable.
Yeah.
I mean, if John's wife wanted to do it, I would certainly chip in. I would help, but I'm not gonna be the front runner on that
right.
At this point.
I know I've been asking a lot of the questions. Jenny, Joe, you guys want to jump in, throw something out there for Don vicariously through Jenny?
Yeah, we have to touch on the short film that you worked on with Trish, Zombie Next Door. I think all of us are huge zombie nuts. Tonight we got Fear the Walking Dead. Yes, hilarious.
I know, big night tonight, right?
Yeah, exactly. Where did the idea for doing like a mockumentary for that come into play for you guys?
Okay, well, this is kind of an interesting story. well, Trish and I had done Beast Wishes, right? And we were sort of riding the success of that. And one of the places that we screened the film is a convention that takes place every year in Louisville, Kentucky, called Wonderfest. And Wonderfest is a wonderful show. It's a great little convention that started out as a sort of a model and toy convention. So it dealt with the art of sculpture and creating model kits and things like that, and then it got bigger and bigger and bigger, and so they started inviting celebrity guests, and so Ray Harryhausen had been there a couple of times, and George Romero was there once, and Tom Savini, and so forth, and so we went there as guests to bring Beast Wishes, but Bob Burns and his wife, Kathy, who are the subjects of Beast Wishes, had been guests at that show for many years. So the fan base there in Louisville, Kentucky, loved them, you know, actually knew them. And so it was a big deal to show Beast Wishes there. So we brought the film there, and we had a great time being guests. And we screened the film to standing room only, and it got a you know, wonderful standing ovation at the end, and Bob and Kathy came with us, and it was just a wonderful experience. And while we were there, the guy that runs it, a great guy, his name is Dave Hodge. He's the sort of head honcho of that convention. Dave Hodge is also one of the keepers. In fact, he's the keeper of the big cats at the Louisville Zoo. That's his real job. So every year that I've ever been there, and including this year, when the convention is over, whoever of the guests that are still around that haven't flown back to L.A. or whatever, or London, wherever they've come from, Dave Hodge invites them to come to the zoo on Monday morning, and he gives us a tour of the zoo, but not the normal kind of tour. He brings us behind the scenes. He brings us into the back areas and the cages back there and gets us up close and personal with the animals. We get to, you know, actually touch a tiger, which is like not something that you get to do every day. It's wonderful. But he's very involved in, because he deals with the big cats, he's very involved in the rescue of big cats from private residences in the Kentucky, Illinois, Ohio areas, which was like these crazy people who, because it was not illegal, acquire, however they acquire them, they acquire cats, tigers, lions, leopards, etc., pumas, and they raise them. And it's actually terrible, because most of the time the conditions are terrible, and that's one of the things that Dave does. He works with an organization that goes in and rescues animals that are being mistreated. Okay, so Dave tells us about a documentary that had been made about the people that he works with. Oh, well, it's not really about them. It's about one of these loons that had something like a dozen or more big cats on his property. And he was running out of money, and so they were being not treated well. And there was a new government ordinance or something like that, and basically he was told that he had to get rid of all but two, I think, of his animals. He had to find homes for them, or they were going to come in and euthanize them. And so we watched, Trish and I rented this documentary, and we watched it, and it was incredible to us. We were like we didn't even know this kind of thing existed. And then I think Trish came up with the idea that what if we did this? What if we made this, but instead of it being tigers and lions that these guys are raising, it's zombies. And I was like, oh. I was like, okay, so then my part of it was, I thought, well, okay, so it's post zombie apocalypse, and I always said that the reason that the apocalypse actually didn't last very long was because everyone had seen so many George Romero movies that everyone knew what to do, so it didn't last long.
Connection's breaking up. Are you there, Freak?
I am still here. Do you hear me?
Yep, hear you now.
Okay, good.
Yep.
So anyway, the idea was the zombie apocalypse didn't last long, and now people had zombies as pets, and some of them kept them. And this one character, this one guy, which was based on the guy that was in the documentary about the tigers, he had four zombies, and the government was now telling him he could only have one. So he had to. So the idea was that he had 24 hours in which to find, or 48 hours in which to find homes for his other three zombies. So we kind of went from there. And what we decided to do was, because you know we did a small crowdfunding, campaign for it. We did a little Kickstarter. We only raised a very small amount of money. We're only looking for enough to basically pay for what we needed to make the movie. But we enlisted a bunch of wonderful people, and like John Goodwin, who was as a veteran makeup artist, Emmy-winning makeup artist, and he worked on Tremors, he worked on The Thing, he worked on Men in Black. He's got an amazing career. And John, we told John about the idea, and he loved it. He was just like, "Hey, look, I'll do it." He goes, "If you just, you know," he didn't even charge. He didn't even want to charge us for supplies, anything like that. Oh, nice. He just thought it was so much fun, and he ended up playing Uncle Billy, who's the zombie in the wheelchair.
In the wheelchair.
Yeah.
You gotta quit dropping your fingers.
and then what we, but here's the thing that really clinched it for us. Number one, this one actor that we knew, he had a haunt that he did every year in October, in Pasadena, that was beneath a bank, right in the center of town, and it was mostly made up of these old cages down there. And he offered us the use of the haunt, but, you know, before, I think it was actually right after Halloween. So they were done with it. So we had free rein in there. And so we had that. We had a location. And then we decided, you know, we knew so many talented actors who were great at improv. Like Allison Martin, who's the sort of the lead.
Oh, yes.
The female lead.
Now, Allison, I loved her in that. Lost Skeleton Returns.
Yes, again. Right. She came from the Larry Belmeyer camp.
Her dance had me laughing. I could not stop laughing at that dance.
I'll tell you something. Remind me later. I'll tell you something funny about that dance. But Allison, you know, we knew from the Larry Belmeyer films, and we knew how hilariously funny she was. And so we decided what we'll do is, rather than write an actual script, we would do what Christopher Guest does with his films, which is like Best in Show and A Mighty Wind, mm-hmm. and, you know, and so I'm Waiting for Guffman, which is write out the plot and write out the scenes as far as what is supposed to happen in each scene. So you'd say, in this scene, this is how it starts, and this is what needs to happen during the scene, and then this is how the scene needs to end. And that's all we would write for each scene. And we gave it to the actors, and we said, and we turn on the camera, we light the scene, turn on the cameras, and let them run with it. And we just said, let's see what happens. So the entire movie, essentially, with few exceptions, is improvised by the actors and by us throwing in ideas as we, you know, so like an actor would say one thing, and then we'd maybe cut the scene and go, "Ooh, let's try this now. Let's throw this idea in. Let's throw this idea in. Let's try this." And so we had a lot of wonderful footage. We shot the entire thing in 2 days. The first day was shooting in the haunt that was under Pasadena. Mm-hmm. And the second day was a couple of months later, was at Allison Martin's house for the Christmas sequences and the suburban outdoor sequences. And we just had fun with it. The reason to do it to begin with was because we had done Beast Wishes. That was our first film for this production company. We knew we were going to be doing Kong, another documentary. So we thought we should do something else that shows that we're not tied down to we're just documentarians. We wanted to do something fun that still had a little bit of documentary in it. It was what you call a mockumentary, but was really much more creative in its endeavor. So that was the opportunity for us to show that we could create a comedy and we could have fun with it and so forth. And it was a blast. It was really, really fun. The people that we brought in, the guy that played Bug.
Yes.
It was really funny. We were sitting one day in our office, which was at the time, it was just Trisha's living room, and her windows looked out onto the street, And one of her tenants was walking on the sidewalk, and I looked out the window and I saw him walking by, and I knew he was an actor, but I looked at him and I was like, he reminds me of Howard Sherman. And I was just like, oh my God, we'll make him Bub. We'll literally make him Bub. We'll make him Bub from the movie, from Day of the Dead. And so we brought it up to Richardson Jones, who played Bub, and he had never seen the movie, so he didn't know who Bub was.
Oh, wow.
So I said, please I think he went on YouTube and he watched the whole movie on YouTube. But he was so good. He really studied how Bub moved and sounded and talked, and he really brought it.
He sounded just like Bub. I had to actually go back and check on who played Bub, because I thought it was the original actor.
Yeah, and John Goodwin had actually not seen Day of the Dead, so I gave it to him. I gave him a bunch of stills of you know, Howard in the Bub makeup, and I said, look, we want to do something close to this, you know. And then for the costume, that I actually gave up my jean jacket this is what I gave up for the movie. I actually took my jean jacket and I sandpapered it, and then I dyed it in black dye and ripped it up and tore it up and everything like that, so that it would be similar to the one that Bub is wearing in Day of the Dead. We just had so much fun with it, and it's really an adorable a little fun movie. My daughter Tabitha is the young zombie at the very end. And by the way, for people who might go on YouTube and watch it, you need to watch it to the very, very end, because there's what we call a Joe Dante at the very end after the credits, which is and it's called a Joe Dante because one thing Joe Dante was always known for was putting a little tiny clip at the end of the end credits that was supposed to be a little treat for the people that were nice enough to stay through and watch the end credits. So there is a little funny little end bit at the end of A Zombie Next Door that you should stick around for. And it was also a little nod to Greg Nicotero as well, so who was my friend.
But it made me laugh from the beginning. I mean, just the description for the YouTube is saying it's Christopher Guest meets George Romero. That drew me in. Two of my favorites. And just within the first couple of minutes when they introduced Bub and saying, yeah, he's a higher functioning one, we found wandering around through the Florida Everglades. And I'm like, oh, yes, yes, just the references.
And that was fun, too, because I got to play around in Photoshop and basically take a picture of Richardson in the Bub makeup and costume and Photoshop him into a shot with standing next to an alligator laying, you know, by the side of a riverbank, you know. There was so much fun creative stuff that we were able to bring to that short. And you know, we only did it to have fun and to show our versatility. There's no money in making anything like that. We just did it for the enjoyment of ourselves and our fans, and people seemed to really like it. They just showed it. It was just this a couple of weeks ago in Louisville, although not a different convention. It was a big convention in there, run by a guy named Ken Daniels, great guy, called Fandom Fest, and he has a film festival that's part of that. And I know they just showed it there like 2 weeks ago. I'd love to have been in the audience to watch the audience reaction, but it's just fun. And that's the important thing too, is that for everything that we do, it's hard work. Anything like this is hard work, but you have to really love it, because if you love it, you'll have fun, no matter how hard the work is. You know, especially if you're doing it for yourself too.
It definitely came through for me in A Zombie Next Door. That, like you're saying, it was a fun shoot and everyone had fun, and that fun translates through for me as the viewer, that you can tell everyone's enjoying what they're doing, and by enjoying it, everyone's playing their part so well, it seems like a real documentary the way it comes off, even though it's, you know, it's not. It's just, it makes it that much more enjoyable.
We really try. I mean, as a director, I strive to keep a light set, and try to keep things as buoyant as possible, because it's very easy when you're under time constraints and budgetary constraints, and you've got a certain amount of pages that you have to get shot in a certain amount of time before you lose the light, the sunlight, or whatever else. You lose your actors, I think it's important to keep people happy and enjoying themselves and well fed. One of our priorities has always been make sure your crew is well fed, because a well fed crew is a happy crew.
Yeah.
Without a doubt.
I can say that as my primary job as a nurse now, as I'm a night supervisor at a hospital, and I know when we have those nights where things are just going bad, I'll order pizzas, and immediately morale has improved.
Yes. So. Yeah. No, it does wonders. It really does, and it also shows that a certain level of appreciation for everybody's hard work. Mm-hmm. I've been on movie sets where it wasn't going that way. And I much prefer a happy set.
Dawn says that she orders Jimmy John's catering for her crew.
Yeah, you know what? And then exactly, but that's exactly it. I mean, do something. Bring an In-N-Out for your crew, or make sure that you're going to order pizzas, that you get a pizza that the vegetarian people can eat. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
It's all stuff that's all stuff that goes beyond just even the creative element of making a film. Mm.
So, I know there's one question Joe and I are both dying to ask, and I'll let Joe take it, because I said this on our last episode that we had done before your interview, that I have a tendency to talk a lot through the show, and I feel like I'm capitalizing too much. So I'm handing this one to Joe.
And we indulge him because he's our fearless leader. But this, I am so looking forward to this movie. You have a part in the upcoming Tales of Halloween.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I'm not
sure. I don't really have a part. I was invited by Andrew Cash, who is our editor. I was talking about, I think in the last sequence, he was our editor on Beast Wishes and okay. working on The Flash and... and he and John Skip directed the episode, which was called War. I think they changed the title of it now. I think I heard them talking about they decided to change the title of the segment. I don't have a role in it really. I was invited to come and be one of the sort of extras in the crowd. And the segment deals with two neighbors, one who is a sort of Rob Zombie or Kirk Hammett kind of rock and roll monster fan, and the guy across the street is more of a sort of a Forrest J. Ackerman old school gentleman horror fan. So old school versus new school, and they engage in a war of... who's putting on the better Halloween?
Lovely.
So and my dear friend Dana Gould gets to play the Forrest J. Ackerman character. And I was very happy to help Andrew secure Dana for that part. but Andrew invited me to come and be one of the onlookers in the big. Battle sequence at the end of the segment, so it was really a lot of fun to go there and that sequence, by the way, that crowd, when you see the film, the crowd that is there in the street is filled with people that work in the industry as writers, as scream queens, as you name it, it's a who's who in there. And I'm sure some of the other segments also feature people that are basically all of our enlarged posse out here. I mean, like the larger group of the people that work in the genre industry out here, that we all know each other. We all see each other. We all go to the same events out here. We're all guests on each other's shows, et cetera, you know? So it was a lot, it was a great deal of fun, to go out there and just be even a small part of it. But that, the reviews have been coming in, have been very positive, and it's got some great directors in there. Mike Mendez, who, did Big Ass Spider and Lava Lantula. Dave Parker, who directed The Hills Run Red, who's a great guy also. You've got Neil Marshall and his wife Exel Carolyn, and just a star-studded group of directors all directing their own little segments of this anthology. And it's been a long time since there's something cool like this out. I think the ABCs of murder?
Yeah, ABCs of death.
Of death, yeah. I mean, that does something like that, I think, also, right? But I actually haven't seen those. But I love, I'm a big fan of the old, like, Amicus anthology films from the 1970s, like Tales from the Crypt and Vault of Horror and House That Dripped Blood and Asylum. I mean, those films I saw those movies in the movie theater when they came out, and so that's a magic window situation that we talked about in the last episode, that, movies that you see at a certain age that, just leave an impact on you, and you carry this love for them for the rest of your lives, regardless of their quality in the end. I haven't seen it yet, Tales of Halloween. It's sort of doing the film festival circuit right now, but I'm really looking forward to it also, yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we've been talking about it for a while because we've been calling it our accidental trilogy of anthologies, because originally we were just going to talk anthology horror movies, which we all love, and then it ended up we did three separate episodes of one focused on anthology movies, one focusing on anthology television, and then one on anthologies in print and short stories.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and that Tales of Halloween came up in the movies discussion. We're all waiting to see that one, because that's about the same time we recorded is when the trailer came out.
And the thing about anthologies, and whether it's television or whether it's feature films, they come with their own set of challenges, because by and large you're talking about different sets, different locations, different costumes, different actors, and that becomes expensive, unless you're really, really clever about it. And then also the other thing that you want to do with a movie, especially, is have some kind of binding element to it, more than just necessarily bookends. And I know that our friend Graham Skipper, who is a wonderful actor who you're going to be seeing more and more and more of, plays a policeman who is all of these segments take place, I think, on the same night, same Halloween night. And I think Graham Skipper appears in many of them, is sort of the running line through that. But Graham Skipper is somebody to look forward to, because he's going to keep getting bigger and bigger, a star, especially in the genre world, because I saw Graham play Herbert West in the musical version of Reanimator last year, which is spectacular.
Yeah.
It's so good. It is so good. I pray that they actually pull a Little Shop of Horrors and make a movie version of it, because I had such a blast. And the actors in it, particularly Graham Skipper and Jesse Merlin, are just dead perfect on target as Herbert West and I can remember the doctor, the David Gale character. The one who gets his head slapped up.
Yeah.
His character's name is escaping me, but they are so spot on perfect. And the songs are great. I mean, it's really funny. It's really good. And, you know, the play, the one thing that the movie won't have if they're able to do it, but the play was wonderful because they actually have a splash zone, which was the first three rows of the audience where they actually gave out people, you know, like plastic ponchos to put on because the blood squirts out all over. It's like sitting in the first three rows at SeaWorld when Shamu does a, you know, does a splash, but funny. What's amazing is that the script doesn't vary from the movie, but when it's played on stage with this sort of funny tongue in cheek, flavor, it is hilarious. It is absolutely hilarious, and like I said, the songs are great. So it's so Graham. That's how I first saw Graham, and I've met him since then. And there's a movie I'm trying to mount right now, a feature, a vampire film that I'm hoping very much that Graham will be able to be in when the time comes. Yeah.
That actually kind of segues to a question that I had in mind. I was just going to ask, you know, what's on the horizon for you? What are some other projects that you've been considering once Long Live the King is done?
Well, I think we're kind of done with the documentary thing. And not that we don't enjoy it. But I think that it's time to move on. And I really, as you know, coming from both an acting background and then having, you know, something of a career in screenwriting, I'm now itching to get back into narrative feature film. So I've written a script that's a vampire film, but not like any other vampire film, because there's been many, many, many vampire films, obviously. We did a reading. We had a reading of it, a table read of it recently, and we had some great actors come in and read with it. We were able to
Don
get a sense
no
of
sparkling.
No sparkling. No. In fact, there's a whole speech. There's a whole speech one of the characters has in it about how vampires are not everything else that you've ever seen. That they're just basically vermin. They're just rats. They're just parasites.
And,
they're not.
And as we
not,
all know, vermin don't sparkle.
Right. Exactly. So, but the cool part about the reading was that there's a small role at the very end of the film, a little cameo part. And I actually, because this movie was written as almost like a love letter to Fright Night, which is still one of my very favorite movies of all time. It's similar to Fright Night only in the sense that it has a lot of humor in it as well as scares. But I just on a whim, I called up Tom Holland and I said, would you mind coming in and reading a role in this script? And he said yes. And so he came to the table read and he read the character. And it was such a big thrill to have Tom there, not just as an actor, you know, playing this little role, but as the man that created the movie that, you know, probably in the big picture, inspired me to write this film, which is called American Vampires.
Nice.
And also for him at the end of it to tell me that, you know, he really liked it and he thought I did a great job and he was proud of me and so forth. So that was a nice little ego cookie for sure.
Yes.
but so I have high hopes for the film. There are people that that have committed verbally to being a part of it. If we can get the more difficult parts of it dealt with, which is always the financing of it. So we've got some producers in Sacramento who really great people that are really dedicated to getting the movie done. So hopefully at the beginning of next year we can actually make the film. There's people like my friend Dana Gould and and Doug Jones and so forth that, you know, have expressed interest in being a part of it. So that's exciting. And that's what I'm really hoping to do next. In the meantime, you know, I do what I always do, which is I get hired to write screenplays. Most of the time they don't get made, but that's still it's still being a working screenwriter. It's still how mm-hmm. I make money. I still occasionally do animation. And with between all those things, I'm just keeping in motion and keeping, keeping an eye toward what's ahead.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Well, that actually comes up. We've actually all together now done about 3 hours of talking. I knew there was potential for this, so. I did have one other question to throw out there, since primarily your King Kong documentary is what prompted all of this to get this snowball rolling. Someone who loves creature films, monster films, are there any that have come out like in the last while of creature films or monster films, be it CGI or practical, that you really liked?
I'm sure there have. I'm just trying to think of exactly. I'll tell you something. I really loved recently the reboot of the Planet of the Apes franchise. I think that I really, really enjoyed Rise of the Planet of the Apes, and even more so Dawn of the Planet of the Apes,
mm-hmm.
Because I think that Rise of the Planet of the Apes was a great way to sort of bring the flock back home after, you know, Tim Burton's, you know, version. A lot of people were very hesitant about looking at a new reboot of that franchise. But mm-hmm. Rise was very clever in that it paid tribute to the original films while at the same time creating its own sort of mythology. But there were little winks to the audience that said, hey, you know what, we get it. We're not going to Tim Burton this. It's going to, you know, we're going to do it right. And then once they had done that, then they didn't have to do it again for the next film. And Dawn of the Planet of the Apes really showed that they now have a strong franchise to work with. And some people don't like the CG apes or whatever. I didn't have a problem with them at all. I think they're remarkable, honestly. So I definitely enjoyed that. I'm a huge fan of. I really like Jurassic World too. Quite honestly, I thought it was terrific. I thought it was really a fun ride and exactly what I expected it to be and a little more. So I enjoyed that, and I'm a huge fan of my friend Greg's show, The Walking Dead, and I would be a fan even if Greg wasn't my friend. I mean, I think it's a compelling show, and what I enjoy about it is what some people argue, but I think are the same things that I enjoy about Romero's movies, which is it's not about zombies, it's about people, it's about humanity and what we go through when we're thrown into situations like this. And it's one of the reasons I'm excited about tonight, which is the premiere of Fear the Walking Dead.
Right.
Because one of the things that we didn't get from the first series was how it all started, which has always been the most fascinating part of it to me. My favorite film is of the genre of the subgenre is the original Dawn of the Dead, because I love that first half hour of that movie where everything is chaos and nobody knows exactly what's going on and so forth. So I'm looking forward to tonight to see how they handle that. We didn't get that with the original Walking Dead series because, you know, Rick wakes up from a coma and it's already happened. So it's going to be fun to sort of see that element, which is I have to admit, a lot of people hate the remake of Dawn of the Dead, but the first 10 minutes of that movie is spectacular in its chaos. I love that. And that's what I'm kind of hoping I'll get to see tonight with this. And I'm proud of my friend Greg. who I've known, you know, for years and years and years, and it's been wonderful to watch him achieve what he's wanted ever since he worked with Tom on Day of the Dead. You know, he's mm-hmm. been working at this for 25, 30 years or whatever, and he's reached, he's gotten what he wanted. And I'm so happy and proud for him. He deserves it, you know.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, I think that about wraps this up. What where can people follow what you're doing and possibly contact you or whatever you want to do, Frank?
Absolutely. Well, we'll start out with I have a website, which is always a work in progress, of course, and that is www.sketchythingsart.com. That's one word, obviously, and that's my personal website that has to do with my artwork and my film work. And then there's also benmonsterfilms.com, which is our benevolent monster website, which is about all of the films that we're working on. Aside from that, please, I'd love everybody to come and listen to my podcast, which is Damn Dirty Geeks, and that's www.damndirtygeeks.com. And there are Facebook pages for myself, Frank Dietz, and there's Facebook pages for Kong, Long Live the King. And all you have to do is, you know, punch in a search, and those will come up, and Damn Dirty Geeks as well. So there's all kinds of things. I have a Twitter, but I'll be damned if I can think of what it is right now. Probably
that Frank Dietz.
Ah, that's right, that Frank Dietz. I saw everybody was no. It's the Frank Dietz.
Yes, right.
It's that Jack Bennett, who's one of our Damn Dirty Geeks.
Okay.
Which had to do because there are so many Jack Bennetts. come to the Facebook page or the websites, and you can find out where we're at, where we're going, where we've been, all of the above.
Don's accusing me of stalking you and says to call security.
you know what? I'm used to the restraining order thing. No problem.
You can catch us all on our Facebook page for the Podcast Macabre. You can catch me at _Duckman_. You can check out my blog, Making It Through the Middle, over on blogger.com. Sometimes I do have horror-related stuff on there. Other times it's just mostly I've been a bit of a DDP yoga fanatic, so I post up weekly what my progress is there if people wish to follow. So, Joe?
Follow us on Twitter at PodcastMacabre. You can follow me on Twitter at ThatJoeMyers.
And Jenny?
You can find me on Facebook. As we've said before, just if you're following us from this show, just give us a heads up that that's where you found us. I'm also on Twitter at Tattooed_Jenny. And my blog is SnarkAttack101 at WordPress.
And
Dawn is our silent partner. She's busily climbing the Empire State Building right now. but she is Dawn Arth Authier on Facebook, and she's BullyandGoal71 at Twitter.
And she says we can find her at the pharmacy trying to retain her sanity.
So thank you so much, sir.
Yes, thank you so much for being our first guest. Everyone else is going to have a very high standard to live up to.
That's cool. It's my pleasure. I'm happy to have popped your special guest cherry. And
you're very gentle.
I'm known for that. Great. Well, thank you guys. Thanks for having me on. It's been lots of fun.
So for this episode of Podcast Macabre, I've been Chris.
I'm Joe.
I'm Jenny. And Dawn is Dawn.
And remember, folks, don't be afraid of dark. Be afraid of what's in it.